Welcome to the Blind Boy Podcast. We're going to begin this week's episode with a short poem that has been submitted to us by French actor Juliette Binoche. This poem is called The Priest. The priest has broken free from the paddock. The steam of freedom careers from his leathery nostrils. His hooves stamp a sad beat on the cold October lawn. We feel the thuds in our chests. There is a mass to be said, but the priest has broken free from the paddock and is running towards the lake. Thank you very much, Juliette Binoche. I loved you in The English Patient. If you're a brand new listener to this podcast, maybe you could start with this episode. I've got a very special treat this episode, a very special treat. If you don't want to, go back to some earlier episodes. There's lots of episodes to listen to. Regular listeners, we've got a special treat. I'm speaking to Graham Norton this week. Graham is the biggest TV presenter in the UK and Ireland, without a doubt. He's also an author. And he's on this week to speak about his brand new book, which is called Home Stretch. And you can pre-order it right now. It's his third book. And fair play to Graham for coming onto this podcast because, like I said, he's massive. He's absolutely huge. So for Graham to come on here and to give me a full chat is very humbling and very nice and very sound of him because he's in big demand and, you know, there would have been a lot of competition from large radio shows, all shit like that. This is a podcast that's run from a fucking essentially a bedroom in Limerick where I still speak into a sock as a microphone. So fair play to Graham. Before I get into the interview, have I got anything to plug? Look, I haven't had fucking gigs in a long time because of coronavirus, as you know. I won't have gigs for a very long time. But I got offered an online podcast festival. There's an online podcast festival called the Unmute Podcast Festival. And they said to me, will you do an online podcast gig? So I said, fuck it, yeah, what have I got to lose? Why not? Let's do it, see what it's like. So on the 22nd of October, I'm doing an online live podcast where I speak to a guest and it's exclusive. So if you want to get a ticket for that, just go to the unmutepodcastfestival.com and look for the Blind Boy Podcast and you can buy a ticket to see a live online podcast. I know it's going to be crack. I've never done one before. But why the fuck not? So if you're interested in that, get an old ticket. Here's the interview with Graham Norton. I just wanted to chat. Listen, this is the whole point of a fucking podcast and what makes it different from traditional media is it's not an interview. It is an interview, but it's you want to create the intimacy of a fucking kitchen. That's what you want. It's an interview, but you leave space for the conversation to go where it needs to go. And it's a nice long interview. It's 90 minutes long. So if you're listening to it, you can get 2 days out of this podcast if you like. Pause it, listen to the rest later. And I'm very happy with how I recorded it. I'm after sorting my shit out with recording podcasts over long distance. So Graham is actually in London. I'm in Limerick. But to be honest, it sounds like we're sitting in the same room because I got my shit together with how I record long distance podcasts. It's better audio fidelity than the one I did with Sami Zayn, which I was really happy with, and I recorded that over Zoom. But I used a new method this time, and the chat with Graham is better audio fidelity. It's closer to the podcast hug. I have a feeling Sami will be back on at some point. I have a feeling me and Sami are going to have another chat again, and when we do, I'll use this method to record it. But here you go. Here's the chat I had with Graham Norton, a talented, funny, and generous person. So, Graham, what is the crack, first of all? How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm getting used to Sure, look, man, we're 6 months into it now, so it does feel normal. And I'm lucky that I have the type of job where I can work from home. So I'm just reminding myself each day to be thankful of that, you know, because some of my friends don't have that. They have to work in shops and shit like that. So I don't allow myself to complain.
Yeah, no, I must say, talking to people who are put on furlough or are freelancers and stuff, like, it's not just the financial thing. It's just they've got so much time. And like, time is a bad thing. Too much time is really, it's that must be hard. So, and also, I think the other thing is because what we do was never 9 to 5. It was never routine. So we're used to being in our house at kind of weird times of the day and for extended periods of time. Yeah, so.
It really doesn't feel that different for me. I mean, I miss gigs. I miss gigs and I miss connecting with people at gigs. But other than that, I've spent my life writing, being on my own, spending huge amounts of time on my own at the expense of kind of social things just to do my art.
Yeah.
The one thing I want to start, one thing that I really want to ask you and that I'm really curious about with yourself, right? And it's a parallel between myself and yourself. You write serious fiction. You write actual serious fiction. But you come from a background of being an entertainer and a well-known face. I'm in a similar situation. I'm obviously not as well known, but I also write serious fiction. It's kind of being promoted off the back of my pre-existing image. But how do you find... Okay, for me personally, I do find it difficult to get received critically as someone who's... It's like all of a sudden, oh, he's writing books now. The lad with the bag is writing books. how you've written 3 books now. You've written A Keeper, Home Stretch, and Holding.
Yeah.
Right? Like, did you find resistance first off? Did people go, what the fuck you mean he's writing a book of fiction?
Well, look, there's that. And also, well, 2 things. One is, what's good is that the bar is very low. Probably not with you. I think people thought you'd be able to write fiction. I think they knew you'd be able to write fiction. I find the disconnect between you, the comic, mm-hmm. and you, the writer, smaller than the disconnect between me as shiny-faced fool on television and a writer. I think the disconnect is smaller. I didn't... When I read your book, I kind of thought, yeah, this is the book that man would write. I didn't think it was that... that jarring that it was you, the man in the plastic mm-hmm. bag, was writing that book. I thought it made sense to me. I could hear your voice in that book. I think it's hard. Yeah. Look, I made a choice, didn't I? I made a choice years ago to go down a particular route. And so I can't really complain now that I'm not taken as seriously as a writer as I'd like to be, because if I'd wanted that respect, I'd have been a writer. That's what I'd have done all those years ago. You know, instead of scrabbling around comedy clubs and piecing and living together doing that, I'd have been doing bits of journalism and writing short stories and all of that. And I didn't do that. The kind of the showing off gene was stronger than the writing gene.
Well, that's one thing, though. When I found myself kind of defending your writing in social circles, if anyone said, what the fuck do you mean he's writing a book? I'd get angry, because the thing is that, like, you started off in doing Edinburgh shows, right? So you started off, essentially, your writing, your comedy, being up on stage, responding to an audience, all of these things, that's writing, that's creativity. So I was saying, well, why the fuck shouldn't he write a book? Doesn't he have a career in comedy behind him? Doesn't he have all these things that have prepped him to do it? Why is it so strange that all of a sudden, what's the difference between a page and an act on stage? It's still taking something from your mind and creating something outside of yourself that people engage with, you know?
Well, especially when I started up in Edinburgh, I was doing like comedy characters and stuff, and I was doing these monologues, and it was really written.
Yeah.
I mean, like if I'd been heckled, I don't know what I'd have done, you know, because I was such an actor trying to kind of get into comedy, and it took me, and that was when, you know, it was difficult because I wasn't a stand up. and people don't really know what to do with you if you're not a stand-up, but you're not, you know, but you're, yet you are a funny person. You are doing funny things and you're doing an hour in Edinburgh and people like it, but actually there's no career there. You like, you might do Edinburgh, you might do the Brighton Festival, you might do Dublin Theatre Festival or something, but that's it. Or Kilkenny, you might do Cat Laughs or something, yeah.
Tell us about, so the when you started in Edinburgh with the Mother Teresa character, are you saying that like you had strict monologues and you didn't deviate from that monologue like that? Was there room for improv? Because Edinburgh's nuts.
Yeah,
people will heckle you. You have to expect to be heckled.
Mother Teresa, she was able to talk to people.
Okay.
And she would interact with the crowd and there were stupid competitions and stuff like that. I think it was...
Tell us about the others. What were you doing? What other stuff were you doing?
I did a show called... there was one called Charlie's Angels Go to Hell, and that was a proper monologue. That was kind of about me in America, and it was kind of, you know, all of that. And
was it about Graham?
It was about me. It was autobiographical, but it was like a little one man play type thing.
Wow.
And then I did I did the Karen Carpenter Bar and Grill. And that was it was a different time.
What year are we talking here?
A long time ago. That would have been 19... Oh, when would that have been? Like mid-90s, 94 or 95, something like that. And that, again, that was all just monologues to the audience. And it had a kind of story. But with Edinburgh, you've got to put in the title of your show in January or something. So you haven't written it, but you just kind of think, I want a show name that stands out. So, you know, Mother Teresa of Calcutta, that stands out. Charlie Saints Go to Hell, Karen Carpenter, Burger Arm Grill. And so you wanted the names that kind of people would notice in the program. But you've got to write a show that has got something to do with Karen Carpenter or Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, man. Like, that's a tough one.
It is tough. When I did Graham Norton and His Amazing Hostess Trolley, and I realized I thought, surely I've got something funny to say about it. No. So I kind of pretended that the show, like I had a hostess trolley in the poster and I just pretended that it didn't exist.
How did you work Karen Carpenter into the Karen Carpenter's Bar and Grill? How did you work her Bar and Grill into it?
I remember the climax was a spaceship that looked like a Fray Bentos steak kidney pie tin came down, and she went away. She was taken away in that. That's the only bit of the story I remember. But it did. I have it. It's in the house somewhere. It did have a structure. It did have a story.
How does it feel? Sometimes one of the things that freaks me about Edinburgh is I think back to doing a show every single fucking night for 30 nights, sometimes two times a day, and I literally can't remember what I did. I can't remember what I did on stage for that long. What the fuck? Are you the same? Like, can you not... you're talking about entire monologues.
Oh,
you haven't
really
remembering what they were about.
Yeah, they're entirely gone. I mean, I've little images, I've little snippets of things that I remember. But that's all. And there's certain shows you remember for all, you know, because what's nice about Edinburgh is it's such a small audience. You know, certainly the venues I was playing, it was always like 100 people tops.
Mm-hmm.
And what's nice about that audience is that you can take them in lots of weird places. You know, like odd things can happen and you don't lose the audience. There's a kind of a trust with that audience because they're so small and you're all in this room and it's kind of what Edinburgh's about.
Yes.
And I remember I used to do this stupid thing just to fill time. And it was a questionnaire. It was an interview with an audience member became a guest. This was before I had a chat show, but an audience member would become a guest. And, you know, and it was just, I got the names. I think I got the names from the tickets or something, or the credit card receipts. I'm sure it was all data breach.
Those scammers do. Not scammers, not hypnotists.
Oh,
what are they called?
The psychics.
Psychics, that's what they do.
Oh, is that where they get the names?
they get the names from the tickets, then they do a load of research, and then all of a sudden, the person is surprised that they know this information that's coming from a dead relative. So you were doing that game without even knowing it.
Without even knowing it. I'd call out the name and they'd come down and I'd give them a choice between topical questions and personal questions, and then both envelopes ended up having the personal questions in it. So they had to answer these personal questions. So anyway, and it was fine, it was funny and da da da. And there's one afternoon I called out the name and it's a small room. This guy put up his hand and he was clearly really ill. He was sick. He was sort of emaciated, grey, da da da. And I kind of thought, God, is he going to be able to get down here? But he did. He got onto the stage and he sat in the chair opposite me. And the last question on this questionnaire was, you can have sex with anyone you like, right? You can have sex with anyone you like, but it's the last time you'll ever have sex. Who would it be, right? And normally, you know, it's a funny question because maybe their partner's in the audience and they're feeling pressure, I ought to say them, but really I'd like it to be, you know, Angelina Jolie, or I'd like it to be George Clooney or something. And with this guy, this suddenly became an incredibly dark, serious, profound question.
Oh my God.
Because you kind of thought, well, you're not long for this world. This is a sort of a true question. And there was nothing funny, but I remember it because it was such a special moment. And I loved the audience in that moment. And I loved him as well.
Was there compassion?
Everyone wanted to hear his answer. And his answer was, it was his first boyfriend who now lived in Australia. That was who he wanted to be with.
Did you get a sense that this person who is looking at their own mortality, or who doesn't know how long they have left, that you'd ask them a question that they themselves hadn't really considered, and it was a big existential moment for them?
I think it was what was nice was he wasn't glib about it. His answer was sincere, you know, because it's a hypothetical, stupid pub drinking game question. Yeah. But for him, it wasn't. For him, it was like, actually, I'd love to see that guy again. I'd like to be with that man one more time, and then, you know, whatever. And that's the magic for me. That was the magic of Edinburgh, that all those kind of crazy things would happen. And everyone, there's kind of a pact that you're all in this funny little hot, sweaty room, and those things can happen.
Do you ever find yourself trying to chase that on television? How do you feel television? Like, do you miss that, or do you feel that in a TV setting, you can achieve that? It's essentially what we're talking about is intimacy. It's a contract of intimacy with an audience and with a room.
And I think on telly, certainly on my show on telly, that's really, really hard. I think on the radio, you can achieve it. Mm-hmm. I think people feel...
What's the difference between the two there, do you think?
Because one, you can't see the audience. You can kind of forget about the audience on the radio.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like two people in a room. I remember Mary Berry was on the show, on the radio show. And, you know, I was stupid. You know, we'd chat on about cooking and blah, 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 blah. And then I say, oh, and you've chosen a record. What have you chosen and why? And Mary Berry looked at me and she'd chosen Sailing by Rod Stewart. That was her choice. And I said, and why did you choose this? And she went, I had a son. And suddenly her eyes were filled with tears. And suddenly I was just, and it was the thing that her son had died, you know, decades earlier. And I think she thought, she was fine. I think she thought, oh, I can say this. This won't move me. This won't upset me. But I think it was somehow saying it out loud in front of someone, me, who I didn't know any of her family history.
Yeah.
Suddenly it hit her. And it was, oh. And that's the sort of moment, you know, you couldn't have on the TV show.
No.
And if you did, I think we've had one guest who cried on the television show. It was John Voight. He moved himself. with some story. And we cut it out. We didn't leave it in. You know, and I
see it's not a safe space. That's the thing. With you and Mary in a studio, that's a safe space. But in a TV setting, often it's not a safe space for raw emotion.
No, and I think also it's very hard to come back from it. You know, Do you kind of go, well, I was going to talk to Greg Davies about his tour. But let's just hold Mary Berry's hand for a while. And, you know, and at least on the radio, we have this moment, but then we play a record. And then that's all, you know, there's a kind of people accept, there's a kind of a grammar that after the record, things will be different. We won't still be crying.
And the power of music as well, the power of music to create an emotional space.
Yes, no, absolutely. Because, yes, and, you know, and it was Rod Stewart sailing and he loved boats and that's why it was so sweet that she thought this was going to be lovely. Oh, great. Well, I love that song because it reminds me of my son. And it overwhelmed her.
What I'd like to know about as well is, so some of the questions I'm asking, they came from the internet. I asked people on Instagram what to ask you.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't
follow you on Instagram. I think of you as a Twitter boy, but are you big on...
I just, Asher, I have to do the whole shebang. Okay. I prefer Twitter. Twitter's better crack. I don't know, Instagram's nicer though. Oh. People aren't pricks on Instagram, but people are pricks on Twitter.
No, Instagram is, I don't know what it is, but I think because people know you're not going to read it. Whereas on Twitter, they know you'll see it.
That's it. That's it, yeah. So one of the questions I got asked was to ask you about your time in a commune in San Francisco when you were younger. And what I'd like to know is in the context of that, but also how do you go from being a young lad in West Cork to all of a sudden knowing that it's like, I want to be on a fucking stage. I want to be on Edinburgh. And was what happened in San Francisco an influence in that?
It was. Those hippies were amazing. They were so good for me. You know, I was 20.
Was it the 80s?
It would have been the 80s, 83, 84, around then.
And what type of hippies, the hippies in the 80s, were they older hippies? Was hippies still a thing that was happening in San Francisco?
It was. Hippies is still a thing that's happening in San Francisco. There are, there are hippie retirement homes now. So that, you know, they can talk, you know, that they speak to their own people. So they're not stuck in a retirement home sitting next to a Trump supporter. They're in a lovely hippie retirement company, you know, and it'll all be eco and vegan and they've done it well. But back then we were in this hippie, it was called Stardance, the hippie commune, and they,
like, how do you get, like, just for me, there's no internet, there's nothing. What, how do you just get on a plane? Did you decide you were going to join the hippies back in Cork?
No.
Or did you get to America?
It was all accidental. I was going to see, this makes me sound older. This makes me sound like a character from Jane Austen. But I had these, I had these pen pals. And I,
oh, fucking I hell. Know. Oh my God.
Do you remember?
Wow.
Remember them? I from everywhere. You signed up with an agent. I think you signed up with an agency.
How do you get a pen pal? How does that?
There was an agency, and you wrote away. You sent it. You paid some money, and you sent in your address, and then you started getting letters from all over the world. Half of them you couldn't understand because they were in such bad English. But and you try and write back.
Did you advertise yourself? Did you say, "My name is Graham. I listen to this music. I like these books."
No.
Or was it just
I think it was more random than that. I think maybe it started in school, you know. I think it might have been a school thing. Because I'm thinking now I wouldn't have paid money. So I think it was something to do with schools. And there was some sort of pen pal thing like that. But anyway, I ended up pen pal with this guy called David Filippando. Isn't that a great name?
Fantastic name.
David Filippando, and he was in L.A. So my big running away scheme was I was going to go and see David Filippando in LA. So I get the J-1 visa. I get to New York. New York, terrifying. I couldn't, you know, I just had to get out of there. But
New York was scary in the 80s too, wasn't it?
And also I'd seen a lot of, what was that? The Equalizer. I remember The Equalizer with your man, Edward Woodward. And
I do not know. But what was the crack with that?
It was just, it was a lot of people being shot in wet, dark streets in New York. And I'd seen too many episodes. So, and also, like, when we got to, when we got there as kids, we stayed in like a YMCA or something in New York.
Was this in like Manhattan or somewhere?
Yeah, it was
like that?
In Manhattan. Like,
and Manhattan was very hardcore back then. That was dodgy.
It was, but it was exciting too. I remember we came through the Midtown Tunnel, and you know, and we were all like, we were pathetic. All these little Irish kids pressed against the glass, like looking at the big cars, and yeah. And then we came through the Midtown Tunnel out into those big glass canyons, and I remember the bus driver. It came on the mic and went, "Welcome to the Big Apple." And we were like, "Yay." And then they took us to the YMCA. And then the next morning, they gave us a talk. And I don't know what the talk was called. I think it was, you know, whatever, orienteering or something like that. But but I said it could have been called How Not to Get Killed in New York. And they scared the shit out of us. And I still do these things. So you never look up. Don't look up. You walk by the curb, not by the wall.
Oh, my God.
And you, if you have to look at a map, go into a shop. Never look at a map on the street.
Don't advertise that you're a tourist or that you're... Wow.
And weirdly, I still do all of that. It's kind of ingrained in me now. And, you know, if I'm with someone in New York and they start looking up at the buildings, I'm thinking, you're going to be killed. Stop it. I'm going to shoot you in the head.
So how do you go from there then to meeting this David Filippando?
Well, I had a 7-day Rambler ticket for the bus, for Trailways bus. Okay.
You went on a bus from New York all the way across the country.
I had with me, and it was going to last me a month. I had £200, right? £50 a week. And because I thought that's more than I was living on in Cork. So I thought, oh, sure, I'd be grand. My parents waved me off. They knew that I had £200 and I was going to America. Like, it was madness. So off I go, get on the bus, Trailways. But of course, because I was kind of, you know, pretentious little git, I thought, I won't get a map. I won't be tied down.
I won't
be tied down by maps. So I would just look for the leaflets in the bus stations that were going, like, that were like a straight line across rather than a straight line up and down. And I thought, well, that's me heading west. Anyway, that's not a very good way to find your way across.
What type of young fella were you, Graham? Like, what music were you listening to? What visions did you have? Who did you want to be? Who did you think you were?
Who did I think I was? I don't know. I mean, I wanted to be... I think I wanted to be an actor, but then I thought I couldn't be an actor because I didn't know how you did that. I just didn't know how you did that. So I think mostly I was looking for adventure, I suppose, or I mean, I wanted to get away, and this seemed like as far away as I could get. And it was, you know, it was like, so much of it was like a movie. Like, I remember I didn't have a Walkman or anything, but I remember being on the bus. And the guy beside me had a Walkman, and bless him, he said, oh, do you want to listen to some music? And he gave me the headphones for a little bit. And I remember I put the headphones on, and it was the, you know, the song from Midnight Cowboy, Everybody's Talking.
Oh my God.
And it was just, suddenly you were in a film, you know, and I was going across a bridge, across some big anonymous river in somewhere in the middle of America. And
you're really lucky with that, man, because the thing is, you got to go to America at a time when you could genuinely experience culture shock. Like, kids nowadays can't experience, like, you can just look at all of America right now on the internet. Like, we're aware that America is a horrible place in parts. We know about it all. But you got to go to America with the vision that had just been sold to you by Hollywood and to experience it that way.
And also to discover that every bus station in America is in a shithole. Like, no bus station is a nice bit of town. They're always in the worst bit of town. So, like, you're literally stepping over people when you are, it doesn't matter where you arrive, that it's just terrible. But what was good was, you know, I had that kind of fearlessness of youth as well. So I probably wasn't as scared as I should have been.
Yeah, the naivety, the wonderful naivety, they can actually serve you well.
Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, and yeah, and it's great so long as you survive. You know, that's why I'd hate to be a parent, because mm-hmm. you'd be so terrified every time your child left the house, because you'd remember all the incredibly stupid things you did when you left the house. But anyway, the long and the short of it was the bus ticket, the 7-day Rambler ticket, it ran out in San Francisco. So I never met David Bilbao. I never.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Did you write to him and say, sorry for not meeting you?
Do you know what? I was ignored. And then my mother, you know, you do these long distance calls, and because it was so expensive, you'd basically you'd call home and go, hello, and then hang up, and just so they knew you were alive. But I remember my mother must have written to me, and maybe she said it on the phone, that this guy, some guy called David Villapando, was calling the house. Because, of course, he thought I was dead. I was one of the bodies you were stepping over getting out of the bus station. And so I did call David Villapando and say, look, I'm in San Francisco, and I'll try and get down to LA, but anyway, it wasn't going to happen. And then I had a phone number for someone in San Francisco. I had one phone number for someone in San Francisco that someone had given me back in Ireland. And
did you know this person?
No, never met them.
Just like, here's an Irish person. Here's someone who's been recommended as sound. Yeah, no, just going to ring him up.
No, she wasn't even Irish. She was some perfectly nice American woman living her life, and suddenly got a phone call from me. And you know, she couldn't help me, but she knew someone, and she said, look, call these people, maybe they'll be able to help you. Anyway, a few phone calls on, I got a room for the night in this hippie commune. And I was just paying nightly to rent this room. And then I think they said, look, do you want to stay? And so I said, yeah, I would. And
what were the conditions of staying like? Is it like a commune? You don't have to pay rent, but you're expected to
You did have to pay rent. You did have to pay rent. It was compared to everyone else, it was really cheap rent, but you did have to pay.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were all those classic things. There was a chore wheel where, you know, you had to clean bits of the house and you had to cook a couple of nights a week. You can imagine how much they dreaded when the 20-year-old from Ireland was cooking.
Yeah. Yeah,
because I didn't know how to make anything. Though I went to the reunion. I went back.
Oh my God! When? How long ago?
Oh, like I was actually, it's quite a long time ago now. I suppose about 15 years ago, something like that. Yeah. I went back, and some of them are still there. Some of them are still in the house, but lots of them had come back for this party, this reunion, and this woman said, "Oh, I still make your soup." I was like, what?
What was the fucking
really
soup?
Some sort of potato and leek thing that I made. But I had no recollection of making this soup.
And were you pulling this soup out of your arse? Or did you have like, did you know like...
I must have, somebody must have told me how to make this soup. But also, even now...
Have they ascribed some type of ancient mythological Irish meaning to this soup that you just brought over that you just fucking invented on the fly?
Some sort of traditional recipe. And it's just like me.
Yeah. Just, this comes from West Cork on the west of Ireland. It was handed down from Cúchulainn over in fucking San Francisco.
So and even now though, I find it very hard to make small amounts of food. I over cater all the time because I when I learned how to cook, it was in vast pots of food.
Yeah,
and that's where I met. That was the first time I met tofu.
Wow. Yeah, there's not a lot of tofu in fucking Ireland in the
80s. No, there really wasn't. And also, it was disgusting. I mean, tofu now is quite nice. They put flavours in it and stuff. It's quite firm. But back then, it was just gelatinous glop. And we'd have that. And mostly vegetarian food. And then you sat on these cushions around these big electricity spools. You know, those big wooden table spool things. There were two of them together. And they formed the infinity table. So there was no head of the table or any of that. You just all sat around. And there was quite a few house meetings involved. And, you know, there was on a Sunday night, you could go to this barefoot boogie where people, you know, all left their shoes in a pile and you'd dance barefoot but in like some community hall somewhere.
Were these people the same age as you? No, were they older?
Much older. They were in...
Were you the only young person?
There was a kid. There was a kid called Mindy. And and what was fascinating about her was, so all the hippies, blah, 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 and then me sort of pretending to be a hippie. And then there was Mindy. And Mindy had no interest in being a hippie. She was going to a school. And so her room was like this weird window into mainstream commercial America. You opened her room and it was just full of Barbies and rainbows and, you know, pink dolls houses. And
yeah,
and you could tell that kind of the mother was sort of embarrassed that it was like a cuckoo in the nest, some sort of capitalist cuckoo.
Yeah,
in the room. But now she's not that. She has, I think she's followed her mother and she's grown into a kind of into a
the irony of that.
I know, weird that children, that all children rebel. That's
But then they return to the values they're brought up with at their earliest life.
Yeah, I guess generally. So, yeah. Well, also decent values. It wasn't like, you know, you would. But I remember that.
Well, do you know what, man? Fucking everyone making soup for each other and having this sharing communal lifestyle is a lot healthier than the ultra capitalism of Barbie.
Yes, it's a lot healthier. But at the same time, she needed it. You know, I suppose. And you would think in somewhere in San Francisco, like at school, she'd have found her tribe, you know, the other hippie children. But I suppose it was kind of, you know, the mid 80s. So I guess it wasn't a great time for hippies. They were on the wane. So I guess she wanted to, you know, she wanted the pink bobbles in her hair and all of that. But the mother
did that experience. What did it do for your confidence? And again, what I'm trying to get at here is like the point in your life where, and I had it myself, where you go, "Fuck it, I could go onto a stage." Do you know what I mean? That point where you go, "Do you know what? I think I could chance going up onto that stage." And it's a strange transition to make.
But did you have a person or did you have a moment? What was it for you?
Do you know what it was? It was so the other rubber. So when I used to be in a thing called the rubber bandits.
Of course, yeah.
You're familiar with that, but like I was in school. I was 16, and up until like I did have a lot of support at home with my creativity. But the thing is, at home, it was either music or painting. It was quite a narrow definition of art, right? Yeah. And comedy didn't fall into that. Comedy and performing didn't come into that. So when I was in school, what I was doing, when I was kind of messing in class or doing funny voices and making people in the class laugh, okay, I thought that was me misbehaving. And I was being informed by the teachers that was me misbehaving. Now as an adult, I look back and I go, no, I was training myself for the stage. When I was in class making people laugh, that's me responding to an audience. Everything I learned that I was doing on the stage in Edinburgh and all this stuff, that came from the classroom. And Mr. Chrome, the other rubber bandit, he came from a family where things like musicals and performing were valued in his family. And he was the first person to say to me, "No, you're creative. What you're doing is, you're not messing, you're not creating trouble. What you're doing is actually creativity." And that's what made me realize, oh fuck, when I make everybody laugh, I know it's disrupting the class, but I'm exhibiting a talent of some description there.
Yeah, it's learning,
and that helped me.
It's learning how to value it too, because it comes easily to you. You think it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
you think and it's only as you get older you realize, oh, actually, the other kids in the class couldn't do it the way I could.
Yes,
the other kids weren't like this is a commodity. This talent. Because, you know, because it's just what you did. It was just your way of your coping mechanism, whatever. You kind of don't think it's of any value. And you see, I see that with actors and stuff where at a read through, they're hilarious in the first read through. They're so funny and good. And you kind of think, oh, aren't they lucky that they can just do this, you know, falling on their head, they can just do it. And of course, they then torture themselves trying to do something else or trying, you know, because they won't accept that the thing they did first was actually that's the best. That's as you know, you have an incredible talent. So just relax. You're great. Yeah. But there is that kind of weird thing where people don't accept it. They don't value it. They've got to torture themselves.
Did you try any performance in San Francisco?
I did. I think I auditioned for a couple of things. Didn't get anything. But the big thing that I got out of the hippie commune was, and it sounds so, I mean, it is hippie. I was going to say it sounds so hippy dippy. It should. It came from a hippie commune. But it was that, you know, they were saying to me, you know, what did I want to do? And I was saying, oh, I'd like to be an actor. And I suppose I always thought, well, I don't know how to do that, or, well, that's not something that I would do, or if I tried to do that, I'd probably fail. And they, in that kind of amazing kind of American way, were just like, well, if you want to be an actor, that's what you should do. You should follow that dream. And I kind of thought, well, that's true, because I realized if I go to London and try to get into drama school and don't get in, then I can think again. But unless I do that, I'll never know if I could be an actor or not. And I remember too, the mother of the little capitalist cuckoo, she'd gone back to school to study to be a nurse. And she was 40 years old. And I remember just thinking how tragic that anyone at 40 would try and start to do something. Like, why would you bother at 40 years old starting a new career? And I must have, hopefully I didn't say it that bluntly, but I must have voiced that opinion to her in some way, because I always remember her saying to me, well, look, if I do this, you know, till I'm 60, I'll have been doing it for 20 years. You know, in brackets, as long as you've been alive, you little dick.
Yeah.
And that was a really good thing at 20 to hear. You kind of think, oh, actually, God, you know, because you're in such a rush when you're young. And it was great to kind of go, God, actually, there's more time. There's a bit more time than I thought there was. Like, I could, you know, fuck around till I was 40 and then start a career, because, you know, you're still going to be, I'd still be doing a job for 20 years, which is longer than I could imagine doing anything for. So it gave me kind of permission to go down some dead ends, you know, some cul-de-sacs and things, rather than kind of being on the fast track and, you know, knowing exactly what I wanted to do and, you know, with having life goals and things I had to reach. You kind of think, actually, the meandering approach is probably more fun, more interesting, and ultimately more rewarding, because...
Searching for failure.
Yes. Brilliant phrase.
Looking for where are my opportunities to fail here?
That's a...
And then recontextualizing, because people... It's a thing that I try and incorporate a lot. Failure is this thing that's seen as a negative. But if you're creative, if you're working in any creative field, you have to search for and embrace failure, because it's the only way you progress and learn. So failure isn't a bad thing in the creative industry. It's just a way to develop.
Yeah, it is. It's got to be about risk. There's got to be about some risk and some challenge. Otherwise, the main thing, that you'll just get very bored if you live a life with no risk or challenge in it. That's a dull life.
We're going to take a tiny little break from the interview there now to let you know that this podcast is supported by you, the listener, via the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindboypodcast. It's a 100% independent podcast. I'm not in anyone's pocket. I get the occasional advertiser, but this is a 100% independent podcast. I have complete editorial control. I get to do whatever the fuck I want, to speak about what I want, and to listen to ye, and to keep this a community-based thing. So all I'm asking is, once a month, if you can afford it, give me the price of a pint or the price of a cup of coffee. Because as well, this podcast is my sole source of income. It's how I earn a living. Because of coronavirus, I can't do gigs. I can't really do any TV. I was probably going to be doing TV this year. They're not making TV. TV is also getting hammered by coronavirus. My book of short stories came out the paperback got released right in the middle of lockdown in March, so there's a big pile of fucking unsold books. So this podcast is my sole source of income. So if you're listening to it, you're enjoying it each week, you're taking something from it, just please consider giving me the price of a pint or the price of a cup of coffee once a month. That's it. If you're liking this, would you say to yourself, I'd buy him a pint? Well, please do. But if you can't afford it, don't worry. Don't worry. This is a model that's based on soundness and kindness. So if you can't afford it, then you can listen for free and someone else is paying for you. And I'm happy, I'm earning a living, and everyone is getting a podcast. But if you can't afford it, please do consider that. Patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. Tiny little break right now for a digitally inserted advert. Acast, who hosts this podcast, they insert adverts into this podcast. So what I do, so you don't get a nasty surprise, I give you a little warning by playing a musical instrument. This week, we're going to play a guiro, which is, I think it's a South American or a Latin American percussion instrument with a very interesting sound on it. So this is the guiro pause. So when you hear the guiro, don't be surprised if you get an advert for some bullshit.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Beautiful instrument. You'll know that instrument from my Twitch stream. I'm on Twitch, twitch.tv/theblindbypodcast. 3 times a week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at around 8:30 p.m. Irish time. I come on, I chat, I play video games. I'm writing a non-stop live musical, 2 video games. It's good crack. You can come on, you can chat with me. Come along to that. Back now to part 2 of the chat with Graham Norton, where we get into a bit of celebrity gossip. Graham gives me a bit of celebrity gossip. Yum, yum. So did you head back from San Francisco then and train in London with a bit of acting?
Yeah, so I came back because I realised, you know, I couldn't live in America because, you know.
What, was that just because of visa restrictions and shit like that?
All the visa stuff, so I had to come back.
So you did what, like a year and a half in San Francisco?
Bit less than that, just a bit over a year, I think. And then I...
Actually, one tiny thing before you move on. When you were speaking there about... you know, being told by the people in San Francisco about the hippies about, you know, you can, if you want to be an actor, you pursue it. Did that give you any type of, how did that contrast to the support you would have received at home? Like, were your parents supportive of, if you said you wanted to be an actor, how does that fly in West Cork?
Well, like, it couldn't fly. It, you know, well, certainly not in my family. You know, I think the idea was, if that's great, you like acting. And they were supportive of my interest in it. Like, my father used to drive me up to Cork to go to rehearsals for The Everyman. And, you know,
yeah,
they supported me as much as they knew how, you know.
And your dad was like a Guinness rep, wasn't he?
So, like, they gave me all the support that they understood how to give. But if I said I wanted to be a professional actor, like, they would, you know, the three of us would just look at each other blankly because that wasn't a thing, you know. And I don't understand why I was so kind of paralyzed by it because there were actors. You know what I mean? Like, there was the Abbey yeah. and there was the Gate and there was RTE. Clearly, there were Irish actors. But the only Irish actor I knew, kind of who knew someone I knew, was Fiona Shaw. You know Fiona Shaw? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she was from Cork. She'd been to UCC and she'd gone to London and she went to RADA. Boom. So okay, I kind of thought, so that is, so that's, the, she's left breadcrumbs for me. I will follow that. And so that was the only thing I knew how to do. You went to London and you went to drama school and then you became an actor. So that was the route. So I did it. I went to London and I applied to drama school and I got into Central. So, you know, following the hippie thing of, you know, follow your dream as far as you can. I, you know, until you reach failure. So I was being, I was finding success. You know, I got in and then I got an agent and then I got a couple of jobs. And that's when the dream, the dream sort of hit, sort of, I was sort of quietly steered into a lay-by and it just stopped. I just didn't get any jobs, really. I kind of, a little flurry of activity early on, and then that was the end of it. And that's how I kind of ended up writing my own stuff. And, you know, how happy am I that I didn't end up being an actor? I'm delighted I'm not an actor.
When did you start to feel like, my first encounter with you was obviously on Father Ted, but like when did you start becoming really comfortable with presenting a TV show? And because I remember your first one, the very first, what was it called? It was on Channel 4.
Carnal Knowledge.
Yeah.
Carnal Knowledge was on, weirdly, that was ITV. That was,
It
was when ITV decided, right, we're going to own nighttime. And
that's why I thought it was Channel 4. It was obviously ITV trying to compete with Channel 4 at
the
time.
Yeah, so they do these late night shows. So Davina hosted one. What was it? Hers was called God's Gift. And that was a dating show for men. Like, didn't men come on stage and then all the women, I think, did the women all crowd around a man and that's how he won or something? I can't remember. But she had a really out there thing. And then we did Carnal Knowledge, which was produced by Rapido, who also made Eurotrash and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And ours was like a filthy Mr. and Mrs. game show.
Yeah.
And of course, we were, you know, back then, people didn't understand. So we signed a contract to do, I think there were 12 shows.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we all came from a traditional world, our agents were like, oh, okay, and then if it goes well, there'll be more shows. They'll do more shows. No, they will just show those 12 shows for about 3 years. They just showed those 12 shows over and over and over again.
But surely there was a benefit in that because at least it means if you're doing some type of live shit, it's effectively an advert.
I suppose. It was just frustrating that you kind of think, oh, like, yeah, because, you know, we didn't get paid to reflect the fact that it was being, like, flogged to death on the telly.
Yeah, the problem with that then is someone then takes your image and they then decide how oversaturated you become.
Well, there's that. And also the people think that's still who you are, you know. 3 years later, I'm still there in an orange mohair jumper going, this is blah, blah, blah. But that's where I'm, well, I knew Maria McCurlin before that, but she was kind of the main host and I was her sidekick. Mm-hmm. And it was grim. Like you'd be huge fights in the car park afterwards and you'd be getting them to drink bottles of Beck's at 9 a.m. to relax.
Oh my God.
It was hardcore.
Everyone wants to know, like, who's been the biggest asshole ever on your show? Is that something you're okay to answer?
Well, you know, the thing about assholes on the show is I'm always quite forgiving if they're an asshole.
Yeah.
Because I got to think, well, look, it's nobody's job. You know, nobody left school and kind of go, I'm going to be a chat show guest. You know, people are something else. They're actors, they're musicians, models, writers, whatever the hell they are.
Yeah.
So if they're awful on the show, I kind of think, well, okay, well, like, we'll never have you back. But I don't hate you because you were awful on the show. Weirdly, I am kind of spared the assholery mostly. It's really the next day when I'm talking to people in the office that I discover the assholery that went on.
Ah, fucking classic. It's never always the case, man. It's the same with me. You meet someone and you think they're sound, but then you ask the assistants, and then it's like, no, this person's a prick. Yeah. They were nice to you, but they were a prick to the people who were underneath them.
And also, you often tell if they are surrounded by pricks, if they've got like a really horrible publicist, really horrible manager, you kind of think, that's odd.
Yeah.
and then you figure it out that yeah. it's a pile of pricks. Mm-hmm. And they're just another one. I suppose for the people backstage, they have a hard time. Like there was one person, I won't say it was, and they already had 9 dressing rooms. I mean, this sounds made up. This sounds like, how can that be true? How could one person need 9 dressing rooms? They had 9 dressing rooms. And you know, we did notice. It wasn't like, that doesn't happen every week. So we were kind of going, geez, they've got 9 dressing rooms. And then somebody came running into the production office, someone from that person's team, going, we have a 911 situation. And we're like, really? What is it? Well, we need another dressing room. And so Catherine, the line producer, she's very calm and she gets on the phone to get another dressing room. We'll get you another dressing room. And while she was waiting on the phone, she just went, oh, out of interest, why do you need another dressing room? And they went, oh, they want to charge their mobile phone. And
yeah.
And that's why they needed another dressing room. And we were talking about it afterwards, kind of like, how does that happen? How do you get...
Yeah, that's my immediate question is, I'm like, I don't need to know who the person is, but I'm going, what level of fame are they at and how the fuck does that happen to a human being?
I think it goes back to the kind of Mariah Carey basket of puppies thing. You know, mm-hmm. where she's backstage, you know, the story about Mariah Carey, that you know, part of her rider was a basket of puppies yeah. that she would play with. And I think where that comes from people making work for themselves, people making themselves indispensable. So mm-hmm. like, so Mariah Carey is sat in a room and you go in and you go, how are you, Mariah? And she goes, I'm fine. Do you need anything? No. Would you not prefer this room if it was white? It's a really horrible color. Would you not prefer this room if it was white? So she goes, I suppose it would be, it would look nicer white. Suddenly, Mariah Carey is demanding her dressing room is painted white. Would you like some scented candles? Would it be nicer with scented candles? Mariah Carey demands scented candles. And then suddenly you get to the point where somebody goes, wouldn't you like some puppies? Wouldn't it be lovely to be rolling on the floor?
And now all of a sudden there's a new job is created called a puppy wrangler.
There you go. Yeah.
So you think it's a culture of essentially grifting a person who has a lot of money to create work?
I think so. So that person was going to charge the mobile phone and somebody kind of went, oh, now it might beep and you want to have a nap. So it might make some noise. Would it not be better if we charge that in a separate room? Because that's the only explanation.
Yeah, it's something in my career, like obviously I'm nowhere near that fucking level of fame, but still I go on stage and I do festivals and you have people who are responsible for your rider and stuff. And it's something I've always battled with over the years, especially when working on TV. Now, one thing I learned is, so when it comes to doing a gig and you do, when I want a rider, I literally just want what I need. And what I need is some food, some beers, some water. That's it. But from an early stage, I was encouraged to be like, no, 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 you can't do that. And I'm like, why? Well, here's the thing with a rider. You need to put on the really weird thing. So my really weird thing on my rider is I need a hand-drawn image of Elvis Costello. And every venue has to give me a hand-drawn image of Elvis Costello.
What's that about?
And what I was told from the early stages of my performance is the rider that I get, my needs, my food, my water, that's not really that important. But what is fucking important is the sound, the lights, all these things out there on stage. So what you do is you create a rider that has some curveballs in there. And by doing that, when I go to a dressing room and I don't see Elvis Costello, then I go, well, okay, Elvis Costello isn't here. What have they fucked up outstage? And then you go up outstage and you see, ah, shit, they don't have monitors there for me. This is the wrong microphone. Now we have a real problem about how the show gets affected. So there is a culture of put weird shit in your rider because it lets you know the quality of the entire venue. If they don't read your personal rider, they're certainly not reading the really important technical rider. So once I heard that, I was like, okay, I'm okay now to have a little bit of weird shit. I don't feel like I'm abusing people or wasting their time. But one thing I will say, Graham, is, and it's a huge thing with me and my plastic bag and my anonymity, like, mental health is hugely important to me, and maintaining a healthy sense of self-esteem and a healthy sense of identity. And when I first started working on RTE, and all of a sudden there's people who are employed as runners, so their job is to come up to me and say, would you like a chair? Would you like a cup of coffee? Now, I don't want someone doing this for me, because I'm like, why the fuck should someone get me? I'm a grown man. I can get my own coffee. But then it's like, please, it's my job. I have to get you coffee. But then it's like, Charlie Brooker did a piece on this too. It's, you let someone get you a chair, you let someone get you a coffee, and then 2 weeks later, you're going, where the fuck is my coffee? And then I have to mind myself around that, because I'm going, am I now becoming a prick? You know what I mean? And it's one of the things that my bag protects me, because I know what it's like. If I'm in Ireland and I can walk into a room with my bag on and everyone knows who the fuck I am. Everyone knows. There's Blind Boy. But I can walk back into that same room with no bag on. Nobody knows who I am. And the experience of those two things is very different. And what I find is when I'm Blind Boy, I don't have to win anyone's approval. Everyone looks at me with this sense of their jaws are open because they're looking at the guy they've seen on TV or seen on YouTube. But when I go back into the same room and even speak to the same people, now I'm a nobody. I have to earn that person's trust through demonstrating that I'm a trustworthy, nice person. And that helps my mental health because I'm engaging with empathy.
Yeah.
Like, how do you find that with fame? Like, you're fucking Graham Norton.
Well, I think that, like, it's weird you say that thing. I remember, and there's kind of nothing you can do about this, but I remember when I first got a show on Channel 4, and I remember going to a production meeting, and I walked in, we were all sat around the table, and I just noticed when I spoke, everyone shut up and everyone looked at me like what I was saying was important. And I'm aware that probably still happens, but I no longer notice it.
There you go.
And, but I am, so you can't continually notice that or you'd go crazy. You know, because it just becomes the way meetings are. So, I suppose.
You know, one thing I can say to you, Graham, in your defense, and it's one of the reasons I was really, really happy to have you on this podcast. I don't know if you remember, right, but about 5 years ago, there was a party for Troika.
Oh, yeah, I remember, yeah.
Because we shared the same agents. And I was just there with no bag on. And I got talking to you. And me and you ended up talking about, it was about your wine. But then we ended up chatting about whatever. And about an hour into me and you having crack, you goes, who are you, by the way? And I'd assumed the whole time you knew I was Blind Boy. And I was like, isn't that lovely? Graham just met this random Irish fella at the party and connected with me the whole night just because I was crack, and then found out I was Blind Boy. And I just found that really a good reflection on your character. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I have to say, and I don't know whether this was intentional, but it's certainly true, that I don't know celebrities. People assume that I must kind of hang out with famous people, and I don't. And I think partly that's to do with that I'm the host. So,
okay,
like, yeah, literally, I'll have a bunch of people on the show, a couch full of people, and we'll have a great time. The show went really well. And the next day online, I'll see a picture of everyone on the couch leaving a restaurant. They've all had dinner after the show.
Ah.
And like,
but you're not present.
Not present, not invited, you know, and I don't care, but I just think it's interesting that because you're sat on that chair over there, you're like mm-hmm. some sort of comedy butler. You know, you've got like your silver tray with questions on it. But the others, they feel like peers on that couch. So I mean, I've talked about this before. There's an odd thing about hosting a chat show where on one level it's very high status because your name is above the door and you walk out and everyone's going, yay, Graham. And that's, you know, the big I am. But the minute mm-hmm. you have the guests out, it doesn't matter how, you know, crappy or terrible they are, you've got to be low status. You've got to be, you know, they've got to be higher status than you. And I think a lot of people who think they're going to enjoy hosting a chat show, that's where it all falls apart, where they suddenly realize.
Because you have to have humility.
Well, you realize it's not about you. The show.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you set the tone, I suppose, but mm-hmm. it is literally not about you. It's got to be about those other people or the whole show is kind of doomed.
You're a DJ, but with the crack instead of music.
That's a very good description. Yes. Yeah, that's exactly what I am.
do you ever worry about, like, so because you use the couch model, and that's the one of the most enjoyable things about your show is you see people sitting beside each other and you never think that these people be in the same room. And that's what's so lovely about your show. Do you ever have to, like, beforehand go, we've two people now sitting on the fucking couch and we've reason to believe that they don't get along with each other?
I mean, sometimes you've got to kind of think, oh God, here we go. Like we had, like, Tom Cruise and Seth MacFarlane were on the couch at the same time. And, you know, there are some, Family Guy. There are some Family Guy episodes that, you know, if Tom's seen them, I can't imagine he enjoyed them very much. So you know, that was a nervous time because, you know, that could go horribly wrong. But of course, you know, as it happens, I think Seth kind of apologized to Tom. I'm not sure if they did it on the show or whether it was a little recording break.
Was Tom aware of it?
He must have been.
Because the thing is with Tom Cruise, it's one thing I wonder about recently. Like, so someone was describing, it was Trump's niece who wrote a book about him recently, and she's also a psychologist.
Yeah.
She said something about Trump, which I found fucking phenomenal, which was, do you know the way people try and assess Trump's mental health from a distance?
Yeah.
She said, when someone is that famous, you can't use the regular rules of society to assess their mental health because they're effectively institutionalized. And I would put Tom Cruise at a level of fame where he's effectively institutionalized.
I mean, that, do you know what I mean? I do.
Maybe he doesn't know about fucking, and also as well, have you ever met someone who's so fucking famous that you're just kind of taken back on, they don't live on my planet. There's something different going on here.
You know, he would be in that category, definitely. And it's not about, well, I suppose it is about him, but it's about me. It's about, I never get past the kind of the line that's been drawn around him. You know, he never seems like a real person.
Is that a physical line now? Does that mean assistance? Or are you literally going, it's Tom Cruise, and I can't get past the spectacle of Tom
Cruise?
Yeah, it's
that. You can't get past it. You never forget. Most people who come on the show, no matter how famous they are, you know, after a little bit of, you know, oh my God, they become a person. You know, and mm-hmm. they either become a dull person or an interesting person or a funny person or a dick or whatever they become. But they morph into a human being. He remains Tom Cruise. And my God, he's good at it. Like, he's so good at it. And I feel like it's his choice. He decided to do that. And I hope it's worth it. I hope for him the rewards are worth it. Because you're right. Like, what he's done to his life is kind of extraordinary. That, like, he won't experience things in the way that the rest of us experience things. He won't know stuff in the way that the rest of us know stuff. Maybe he remembers, you know, maybe he can think back to when he was a boy and when this was his dream. You know, it's that...
Bob Dylan said something once which was just jarring and kind of depressing. So Bob Dylan is also at that level of fame. And Bob Dylan was saying that when he goes to a restaurant, even a famous person restaurant, everybody changes how they eat when Bob Dylan walks into the room, including someone like Robert De Niro or Bruce Springsteen, because it's Bob fucking Dylan. So Bob Dylan doesn't get to be a normal person even around other famous people. And Tom Cruise is also that.
Yeah, he would be, definitely. I mean, that's... And
I think personality types, like, I mean, okay, so the reason I wear a fucking bag is I couldn't handle any notoriety. That doesn't suit my personality. I've got a history of anxiety, agoraphobia. I like being an artist. I don't like being recognized or well-known. But I think some people do have the type of personality where being completely recognized and everyone knowing who you are, that suits who they are and that works for them.
But does it though? Because I think what's incredible that you had the foresight to know.
It was season one of Big Brother. I first started doing Rubber Bandit stuff in season one of Big Brother. And I watched the guy who won it was called Craig. Yeah. And I watched how he became the most famous person in Britain and Ireland. And then after 2 months, he wasn't. And then after 6 months, he was like working in B&Q. But people were still coming up to him. And I remember thinking, Jesus Christ, fame is so disposable right now. Imagine being really famous, but you don't get to live that life or have the trappings of it. So you're essentially just being a regular person, but being bothered all the time. And it scared the fuck out of me.
Don't you wonder, why is it that, because those Big Brother people back in, you know, season one, season two of Big Brother, they were more famous than God. I mean, they were so famous.
Yeah.
Mad. And yet, the kind of the bad things that have happened after Love Island, you know, people's mental health mm-hmm. now seems to be worse, or fame seems to...
Social media,
is
man.
That all it is? Is it just the people are sitting on Twitter scrolling through vile stuff about themselves?
The only people who were absolute pricks back then were the newspapers. The newspapers were horrible. Yeah. Like the treatment that Jade Goody
and
got.
And then you could throw it away.
You can throw it away. Or you can say to yourself, it's a journalist's job to be a prick. But with social media and it's real people, and man, people are fucked up on the internet, you know? People really, there's some people who really try and hurt people with words. Really, really have a good think about hurting people with words. And
you said a brilliant thing about that, about you look at the little avatar and you see that it's a man and he's holding his granddaughter or something. And
or rubbing a dog.
You kind of think, like, they're not that. They are, like, they have goodness in them.
Yeah. And I try and latch onto that. When I see, like, an old man rubbing his dog and he's on the Daily Mail comments calling for the death of refugees, you know, it does jar me because I'm going... You have enough compassion to put your dog into a photograph. You have enough compassion to tell your granddaughter you love her. What's going on here?
Yeah, I mean,
in this moment of hatred that you have right now.
I find that fascinating. That weird thing where it's like road rage, I think. It's like, you know...
Oh, very similar.
Where
yeah.
you call everyone every name under the sun when you're driving. But like even if your window was down, you wouldn't do it because you'd be...
Or something as simple, Graham, as you could be in traffic and you'll pick your nose if you're in the car, but you will not pick your nose walking down the street. The car gives you this sense of this illusion of privacy that I think social media does the same thing.
Yeah, but you think you're not vulnerable. You think you're, I'm protected here because I'm in this car of Twitter, my Twitter mobile.
But
it's a bit like, because I didn't learn how to drive till I was in my late 30s. And the minute I got in the car, I was furious with everybody. And I go, where was this anger? Like,
what the fuck is that?
What was my vent? What was my outlet for this anger before I drove? And it's a bit like that with Twitter, where you kind of think, before these people had a Twitter thing, they weren't out in their garden screaming at neighbors. They weren't, you know, in the supermarket just throwing packets on the floor going, I hate this, I hate it.
Or calling for genocide. Yeah,
that too. And you're like, how did it... Like, it's weird that anger is in us. It just needs an outlet. But yet, if you're not given the outlet, you seem to be fine. Like, I didn't feel... I wasn't walking around like a pressure cooker before I had a car.
Yeah.
But the minute I had a car, Mr. Angry.
And were you shocking yourself going, I didn't know I could get this angry. Why am I beeping this horn? Why am I screaming?
I don't beep the horn. I'm not that angry.
Okay.
I probably am, but I'm not.
Was it a silent car
a
rage?
A very silent car rage. But no, I would be verbal. I would be like screaming inside the car.
Yeah.
I've got better. I have calmed down. And also because I think London traffic moves so slowly now. There's no sense. Nothing's holding you up.
Yeah.
Because it all just crawls along. So you just have to give it up.
I'd love to talk a bit about your writing process, right? Like, you've written three novels since 2015 you started the first one. Like, that's a pretty large output in 5 years. How do you find the time? What's your routine for writing your books?
With me, I want to write, you know. It's not like homework. It's not like, oh geez, I'm going to do that. It's the thing I look forward to. I like getting lost in those worlds and those characters and the story.
Oh,
I like all of that.
Yeah.
So if I've got time in my diary, I kind of say, ooh, that could be, those are book days. Let's do that. And I look forward to those days because I'm sure.
What does writing feel like for you? Do you ever feel... Do you feel like you're kind of watching a film in your head and your story is revealing itself to you? Or are you thinking more about what's going to happen?
It's a bit of both. You know, on a good day, it's like watching a film and you go, oh my God, mm-hmm. I had no idea that was going to happen. And like, you know, when I interview writers and they talk about, oh, the characters took on a life of their own, you just roll your eyes and go, for fuck's sake. But
until you do it.
Then it happens. Then you're in it. And now I'm that pretentious prick talking about then my characters, blah, blah, blah. I realized my character couldn't do that. And, you know, what are you talking about? But it is true. And those are the good days. Those are the days when you're like, oh, I love this. And then there's other days when it is heavy lifting and you kind of think, oh, how am I going to get them to hear? Or how can, you know, I solve this problem?
Because you have deadlines. You've got deadlines. You've got a publisher saying, Graham, this book is coming out next year and we need it finished. So how do you tackle
that's the gift.
Do you put a word count?
You've got a word count and...
What's your daily word count?
Oh, no, I don't have a daily word count. I just have an overall word count. The overall is about 100,000. So the deadline is great. The deadline is the reason that I think any book is finished. I mean, I'm so in awe of, writers who... write novels on spec and then send them off to agents and publishers.
Yeah.
Like the idea of typing the end when no one was waiting for you to do it. Because I think there's always something. I mean, maybe it's different with short stories, but with a novel, there's a bit about 2/3 the way through. And I've talked to other writers and they all go, yep, that's right. And about 2/3 the way through where you just kind of think, no one will be interested in this story. No one wants to meet these characters. Mm-hmm. Why am I continuing? And that would be the point where most novels end up in a drawer or on a memory stick. But because, as you say, publishers are going, where's that novel? You have to push through that big wall of self-doubt and get to the end.
Do you have support from your editors with that? Like when you get to that point, do you ring up your editor and go, look, I don't give a fuck about these characters and I can't see why anyone else will. I mean, what are those conversations?
I don't have those conversations because the whole point of these books is I don't have any conversations. The books, I mean, I do in the end. In the end, once it's finished, then I've talked to editors and da da da.
Is it very private for yourself, the process?
It's private, but private makes it sound like it's secretive. It's not secretive. It's just completely personal. It's the only thing in my life where I'm calling all the shots. It's just about my imagination. Whereas, you know, most things I do, there's either a meeting about the show or you're having to deal with someone else, or they're saying, oh, we can't play that music, or, you know, the guest doesn't want to talk about this, or, you know, there's always something else to consider. And with the books, there isn't. Or if it is, it's something I've put in. It's a break I've put in place myself. It's not. It's a self-imposed thing. It doesn't come from external forces.
Do you feel that you... What's your relationship with your Irish identity? Because that was another real common question that was asked. Like, I do find that Irish people were very, not claiming, but I mean, like, sometimes people look at Irish people who go to the UK and do TV as if it's a soccer team and as if going to the UK is some type of betrayal or something like that.
You know.
How do you feel about your Irishness and your Irish identity? Is it important to you? Is it part of who you are?
Well, it has to be part of who you are. And that's part of the, like, one of the, this latest book, Home Stretch, that's kind of one of the themes of that book is, you know, I've talked about this before when, you know, I didn't leave Ireland. I ran away. I couldn't wait to get out of the place. That was me done. And
Home Stretch is it's about a woman who's in New York. She finds out that her mother dies.
That's the last one. That's a keeper. Home Stretch is about, if there's a crash, three kids die, live, and it's about the kind of following the life of the driver of the car. But I remember, you know, when you leave Ireland and you think, right, that's it, you know, done. And you come to England and you know, you don't go anywhere near Kilburn. You kind of think, I've grown up with, you know, 4 million of them. I don't need Irish people in my life. Da, 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 da. And you're making new friends. You've got a career and all's fabulous. It's great, 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 great. And then you're at a party and you bump into an Irish person. You've never met them before. You don't know them. And you get talking to them. And it's that, and when you're young, this is depressing. Now I find it lovely. But when you're young, it's depressing. Mm-hmm. You're talking to this Irish person and you realize, oh God, I already know this guy better than I will ever know anyone I meet in the UK.
Yeah.
Because they watched Wantley Wagon. And they know who Mike Murphy is. And you just have this shared history, these weird bonds. And as I say, when you're a kid, I think that's depressing. Now, in my 50s, I love that. I love that I have a bond with this place, that when I go back to Ireland, you know, I haven't lived in Ireland full time since 1983. So I've been out of the place far longer than I was ever there. But when I go back, like, I know Ireland better than I will ever know the UK. Like, I wouldn't have the confidence to write a book set in Britain. Like, I don't know what the inside of people's houses look like. I don't know what their conversations are. I don't know what English people talk to each other about. And I don't know what their conversation sounds like. You know, and I read books and everything.
Yeah, the intimate, private. Yeah, I wouldn't have a fucking clue either. What the fuck do English people talk about when they're eating the roast beef? You know, I don't know.
And it's weird because I should know. I mean, that's stupid that I don't know. I've been here for so long. But I don't. Now, having said that, I do feel at home here. You know, like when I get on the plane to go to Cork, I'm going home. When I get on the plane in Cork to come to London, I'm coming home. You know, I pay tax here. I vote here. My career's here. It'd be mad if I didn't feel some sort of sense of identity with London. That'd be crazy if I still felt like an outsider. I don't feel like an outsider. But equally, I think London is a kind of a separate thing, isn't it? Because
It is.
Who knows Londoners? I don't know any Londoners. I mean, you know, all my neighbours are from somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. You're pretty serious about your wine as well.
I mean, I love it. And also, I think if you're going to put your name...
Yeah, that one other question. Do you get drunk on your own wine?
Yes. I mean, I get drunk a lot less than I used to, I have to say. And I don't like talking about it because I feel like I'm... You know, because if you say, oh, I've cut down my drinking, it's like I'm judging the person I used to be. And no, I'm not. It's not that. I don't know what. You just get older and, you know, sort of.
Hangovers get worse, man.
It's not so much that. I remember when I was writing sort of a memoir-y thing, and it was called The Life and Loves of He Devil. And I chapters of all the things I loved. And I wrote one chapter on drink. And I thought, oh, that'd be good. I'll put all my funny stories about being drunk in one chapter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you put all your funny stories about being drunk in one chapter, it really stops being funny. It just becomes sort of tragic by the end, you know, and things like, I remember I was in a bar in Shoreditch and it was this tequila bar and we were all doing shots and da, 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 da. And I left I was going home. And anyway, about, I don't know how long, longer, maybe 45 minutes later, my friends found me asleep, leaning against a lamppost.
Oh my God.
This was only about 5 or 6 years ago. And you got to think, now that is cute when you're 22. If you're 50, that's fucking awful.
It's the front page of the Daily Mail.
Like, you
well.
Can't be asleep against a lamppost when you're 50. So I just thought, I this doesn't suit me anymore.
I think
that's what it is. And also, I don't want to, it's that weird balance of control in your life, isn't it? So I don't want to say I'm giving up drinking, because then I've given power to the drink. But equally, I'm telling the drink, I can not have you. I don't have to have you. So it's a weird kind of power balance between me and alcohol, and trying to kind of assert my control while still enjoying it.
And one last question for you, Zor Graham, right? With your books, when you're writing, do you ever feel that, like, how much self-discovery, how much, like, almost therapeutic going into yourself, going into your childhood, your early memories, do you ever find that about your writing process?
I mean, what's interesting about it is that it all comes out of you, you know, like, you must find this where, you know, you're writing something and no matter how odd or extraordinary it is, it's in you. You haven't mm-hmm. plucked it out of the air. You're not channeling it from somewhere. It's stuff that's in your brain. And I think what surprises me is sometimes the empathy you can have, or how the facility you have to put yourself in situations you thought you knew nothing about. And suddenly you kind of think, oh, actually, weirdly, obviously I have experienced that, or I can imagine it really vividly. And those are the kind of the surprises, I suppose. And also the overall surprise is, I think, that these books that I've written, these novels, are much more sentimental and kinder than I ever thought I would be as a fiction writer. I imagined my books would be quite snarky and cruel and a bit world weary and jaded. And actually, turns out that's not who I am when I write novels. That's not where my mind goes to in fiction. I'm sort of an old softy, really.
Does that make you feel good about who you are now, your sense of, because one thing I noticed earlier when we were speaking about, you know, when you're younger and you meet Irish people, you have this sense of resistance, which to me, that what stuck out there, it's like when a teenager is exploring all these different types of music or types of dressing as a way to find out who they are. But now as you're older, you don't find resistance to meeting Irish people. You find it kind of warm. Like, when you're speaking about there, are you comfortable now with a sense of identity as this, saying to yourself, fuck it, I'm actually quite kind and empathic and my stories are telling me this. Is that a comfortable sentence?
Yeah, no, it is a comfortable sentence. And I feel, you know, as you get older, God, you better get comfortable in your skin. You've so much of it.
Yeah.
You want to relax into yourself, and you want to have a sense of who you are. Because I think, if you're still struggling in your kind of late 50s to kind of find yourself or to like yourself or accept yourself, you know, I said earlier, we've got more time than we think. But at the same time, there comes a point when you need to kind of be in your groove, I think, or
acceptance. This is who the fuck
and
I
also
am.
Accepting what you're good at, what you're not good at, what you're never going to do. You know, I'm all for follow your dream. There comes a point when you've got to give up on your dream. There comes a point when you're kind of like, that's not going to happen anymore.
And the process, the grief around that, we speak about grief in terms of the death of people, but quite a few people experience grief around the death of dreams.
Absolutely. And a bit like every sort of grief, you know, there is a process to get through it. You know, there are all the, you know, all those things ending in acceptance. And that's where you've you've got to get to. Otherwise, you know, you're that person that you meet who's, you know, still working on a demo or still having meetings about something or other. And, you know, we've all known those people. And you think, oh, mm-hmm. God, you know, I suppose if it still drives them, I suppose if they're still moving forward and it still gives them, it feeds them in some way.
It's the relationship they have with it, Graham. What I always think of there is, I remember it was like, I was seeing, it was fucking Dragon's Den or something like that. And it was a dude who, he had an idea. He'd invented a new type of sport like 30
that's
years
big.
Ago. That's very
inventing
big.
Inventing a new sport. Was, that's ambitious.
He was living out of his car. Because he was so sure that this sport was going to, and it was 30 years into it, and he was living out of his car, he'd sold his house, and it's like, look, I've got this new fucking sport, and I think he could be in the Olympics. And it's when it's that, it's his relationship with his dream is now unhealthy.
Yes.
It's not like, I've got this sport, and I think about it in my spare time, but it's not impacting my fucking quality of life or my family. But it's like, now your relationship with your dream is fucking up the quality of your life. That's where it's a problem.
And I think it's people got sold a lie somewhere along the way. I think when I was
the Yanks started that.
I guess they did. The Yanks are the people who told me to follow my dream, and I did. But my dream then morphed into something else.
You were right. You followed it in the right direction. But what about people? I think it comes from, if you look at the history of America and frontierism, it's just like they took this country and it's massive. And we're told, just go forth and take whatever the fuck is there, and there's gold in them there hills, and keep going. And that now manifests itself in the American psyche. But it's like, yes, but you need to have limitations too. You need to self-reflect. Is this dream, if you're too deep into it and it's impacting your life and you're living in your car because of a fucking sport, you got to go, maybe this is the wrong dream. Maybe there's a mirage.
I'm not a parent, but I always kind of think, if I was a parent, don't put all the drawings on the fridge. Like some of the drawings must be better than others, and more work went into some of the drawings than others. And like, I think people should recognize, you know, that hard work is required. It's not, you know, every, you know, it's that thing, your little princess or little prince, and da, da, da. It's like, that can't be that healthy in the end, because your expectations need to be managed in some way. And yet at the same time, you don't want to crush people. There must be some weird, there must be some happy medium where where people kind of, you know, they can dream, but at the same time, they understand that there are kind of practical things in life that you have to address.
For me, I've always viewed what I do as a hobby. I've always viewed it as a hobby. And the bag also was part of that. Another reason for my bag was like, because I went back and did a master's 5 years ago. I'm always have my in my awareness, fuck it, what if this doesn't work out and I have to get a different job? Well, that'll be quite easy now because I have a bag on my head and I don't know who the fuck I am.
When you did your master's, was there like a kind of, did you come out? Did you meet new people? And then when you got to know them well enough, you'd go, actually I'm a blind boy. And
yeah. So when I was in my class, it was a small class of about 12 people. After a few weeks, I just kind of said, look, this is my art. This is what I do. I'm doing my master's around this. And I'm going to ask you to respect the situation. But once they'd gotten to know me, they didn't give a fuck that my other life meant I had a fucking bag in my head.
So I'd
established trust first.
But so it never got out.
No.
But that's really impressive, because you would tell people, you would kind of go, you'll never guess who's in my class.
I'd say they did a little bit, but they'd have never like asked for a photo. People never come in and said, they did at the end, at the very end when I finished my master's, certain people said, look, my brother's a massive fan. All right. I didn't tell him, but we're coming near the end. Will you sign this for him? Will you do that? But people generally, they're really respectful of it because they understand my reasons behind it, you know, and you just put in the work to show them that you're a person who's worth trusting.
And do you think you'd ever have another life where you were something else as well, and maybe that person did have a face?
Not publicly, right? But like, I trained to be a psychotherapist years ago, and I quit because of Horse Outside. And I would like to think maybe if I give up this, that I'd go back as a psychotherapist, not in the public eye, but just someone who helps people through therapy.
Yeah.
You know, I do get asked a lot by my agents and all that shit. Will you just take off the fucking bag and then we can sell you in the UK for fuck's sake? But I'm like, no, thanks. It doesn't suit me.
I think it's brilliant that you know that, because the thing about, you know, I think people think they want to be well known. You know, all those kids who go on Love Island and all those things, they think they're going to enjoy it. And it, like, you need to be, you need to gird your loins for it, particularly now, as you were saying, you know, that whole social media thing. Like, it's not going to be as fun as you think it's going to be. There are perks, there are nice bits, but, and also it's that thing that you can't turn it on and turn it off. That's what's brilliant about
you.
You've got a tap. Yeah. And you pop that bag on and look at me, the big I am, and it's wonderful. But then you can just go to the shops.
And I can, as you were saying earlier, I can get drunk and fall asleep against the lamppost.
You're young enough.
I'm young enough, but still, like, I can do that with my friends, you know, and I don't have to worry about... I mean, the fact of the matter is, you went out, you had a good night, you got drunk, you fell asleep against a lamppost. Yeah. How easy is that to frame in the paper that you are now, your life is falling apart and you're destitute?
Oh, very easy. I mean,
there you go. And how many times have I seen people in the newspaper who, I don't know, they were at a house party the night before, they had a hangover, famous people, and all of a sudden, the newspaper is like, this person's life is in ruins. And it might not be true. Maybe they just...
But I find there's a very odd thing with newspapers where I know that everything I read about myself in a newspaper isn't true, or at least it's off. It's skewed wrong, or it's they put a spin on it that isn't correct. And I will read the thing about myself and I'll go, rubbish. And I will literally turn the page and read a story about someone else and go, oh, well, I didn't know that. Oh, poor them. That's terrible. And it's...
Oh,
but it's so
Graham,
weird that you can't, I cannot make that connection.
Yeah. Fucking hell. That's 90 minutes there, Graham, right? So I just want to say, look, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And not just for doing the interview. I'm 6 months in fucking lockdown, so I don't get the opportunity to speak to people. So it was just a lovely conversation as well. So thank you for that.
Really, really nice to talk to you. And I'm not just saying this. I am such a big fan of your podcast. It really is one of
thank
the best
so much,
ones
Graham.
Out there. You've got just a brilliant, brilliant mind. You're fantastic.
What an absolute gent. What a lovely cathartic chat that was. It was, like I said there at the end, it didn't feel like an interview. It felt like being on the phone. Felt like being on the phone and having a lovely conversation and a chat with someone who I had stuff in common with, you know. And I loved doing that. It was just nice. The rest of my day after that, because I'm kind of locked up with quarantine, you know, I miss human connection. And when I did that chat with Graham, I was on cloud nine for the rest of the day. I was buzzing. I had endorphins, you know. I'd made a human connection. I'd engage with empathy. So thank you to Graham for that, for doing that. It was fantastic. I'll catch you next week. Don't know what next week's podcast is going to be about. Probably a hot take. We'll see what the crack is. All right. If you're a new listener, thank you for sticking around. Listen to some old podcasts. Subscribe to the podcast. Like it. Fucking follow it on Spotify. Whatever. Share it, man. Share it with a friend. Especially if you're not living in Ireland. If you're in America or Australia or Britain, if you like my podcast, show it to a friend and get him to listen. That stuff really, really helps. Okay, yart.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.